It'd just be too complicated to put all those organelles in there, I think. You'd get lost in the detail. Oh, no, no, no. None of the organelles get thrown out. It all just stays right in there. All right, so this is Bio 231, and it's Wednesday, September 3rd, and you have a test in 1 week from today, so next week. And who knows what's on the test? Chapter 1, Chapter 2, and Chapter 4, and I don't know about 5. Integument, yeah, I think integument is on there too, so 4 chapters. So we still have to go over the integumentary system. I covered everything pretty much. We're a little bit ahead of schedule. But I do want to go back to histology for a little bit. Tissues for just a little bit. I just want to maybe ask you some questions to kind of get you on track. So remember, there are how many different major tissues in the body? There's 4, right. And you should really know what those are. They're epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. Right. And what can you tell me about an epithelium?
Cover.
It covers a surface or it could line a cavity. Covers a surface or lines a cavity. And how would we classify an epithelium? 2 major ways that we classify epithelium. By layers, number one, and the shape of the cells. And so the shape of the cells are squamous if they're flat, cuboidal if they're kind of like a cube, or columnar if they're taller than they are wide and deep. And then the second way is by the number of layers. If it's one layer, what do we call it?
Simple.
If there's many layers?
Stratified.
And how do you know if it's simple or stratified? What are you going to look between? What are you going to look between? You're going to look between the apical surface, which is the free edge that's open to the outside world, or a lumen of a tube or something. So the apical surface and what? The basement membrane. So if there's one cell in between those, then it's simple. If there's many layers, then it's stratified. And don't forget, there's a weird one. Depending on where you look, sometimes it looks like a simple epithelium, sometimes it looks stratified. We call that pseudostratified. And it always has cilium on there. That's right. So it's a pseudostratified columnar ciliated epithelium or some order like that. All right, and then there's one weird one that doesn't fit into either one of those categories or any of those 4. That's transitional. And those you can always tell because the cells kind of look pillow-shaped. They're just kind of round or oval, right? And those we find in the ureters and urinary bladder. Okay, connective tissue. When you take your lab practicums, make sure you say whether or not a tissue is connective tissue. Don't say, for instance, muscle CT. Why wouldn't you want to say muscle CT? Skeletal muscle CT. Okay, because it's abbreviated, but the big reason is that muscle is what? It's not connective tissue. It's a tissue all by itself. All right, so you should have in your mind clearly what tissues are connective tissues. Like, give me some examples of some connective tissues. Blood. Yeah, what is, what's the matrix in blood? Is? Plasma, it's the fluid part. It's the fluid part. So the matrix is what? Everything outside the cells, the extracellular space. And generally, what can you tell me about connective tissue and the matrix? What is kind of more important in connective tissue? Is it the cells that make it up, or it is the matrix? Yeah, it's the matrix that really gives connective tissue its important properties. But in an epithelium, there really is no matrix. There really is no extracellular space. The cells are packed closely together. All right, and the reason why I'm kind of belaboring this point is because there's one kind of connective tissue that's highly atypical. You might think that blood is kind of funny because it's a fluid connective tissue. It flows. And bone is a connective tissue. What's in the matrix of bone? Osteocytes are cells, so that can't be the matrix because the matrix is what? Outside the cells. It is, and you knew this before you took this class, it's calcium, right? There are minerals in bone, calcium and phosphate. When we get to bone, you'll learn some more features about the matrix, but it's basically calcium. Okay, so those osteocytes really don't form the matrix. Those are the cells, right? All right, now, there is an interesting kind of connective tissue because it has almost no matrix. which goes against the generalization of a connective tissue. And I'm not sure you know which one that is, because I skipped it last time. I said I was going to go back to it, and then I forgot to go back to it. So there is a connective tissue where the cells are tightly packed together. There's very little extracellular matrix. It's a connective tissue. It's a loose connective tissue. And it is adipose tissue. So let me see if I can find a picture of adipose tissue. I said I was going to go back and take a look at it. All right, so here is a pretty good picture. So here is an adipocyte. Let me even zoom in. All right, so here is an adipocyte, and what is this right next to it? Another adipocyte. So there's very little extracellular matrix right here. Right? And all of the lipid, all of the fat that makes adipose tissue, so another name for an adipocyte is a fat cell, but I don't really want you to use that term. Adipocyte is probably more proper. All of the lipid is contained within inside the cell. It's not in the matrix. So in terms of adipose connective tissue, the important property of this tissue is what? Intracellular, because that's where the lipid is stored. So that is 180 degrees different compared to what you should know about other connective tissues. Right? So as a matter of fact, so here is the cell, and you can see how the cytoplasm and the nucleus is squished way to the perimeter of the cell, and the inside of the cell is mostly one big, what, droplet of lipid. All right, so who's got a question about why adipose CT is atypical? Because it really doesn't have a matrix, right? Okay. All right, so that's, I think, all I wanted to say about connective tissue and histology. Now, does anybody have a question about that? No? Okay. So the pictures in your book are really good because it tells you something about the cells that make up connective tissue, what they look like, what the fibers are, and a little bit about the matrix. Yeah. I don't think I have that on the study guide. It's good background information, maybe, but I don't remember what it looks like, tell you the truth. So I don't know. Okay. So the exam figures that I have on Blackboard, the objectives, and I tell you what, if you go to my AMP and you find a question that relates to the objectives that I want you to look at, then those are probably good questions. You might see questions that are similar to that on a test. Okay, but I think the questions are going to come from the figures, and it's going to come from lecture notes primarily, and maybe some of the end of chapter questions. Okay. Yeah, figures. Yeah, that's what I mean when I say figures, because they're listed as a figure, so they're illustrations. Usually, I don't put photographs because they don't photocopy very well, but illustrations do. Okay. Okay. Oh, let's see if we have the internet up and going. Oh, I sent everybody an email. Did anybody get an email from me? Okay. If you did not, then please go into Blackboard and under the Tools section, click on Tools. Go to personal information and check your email address. Make sure it's a valid email address in there. Because I sent everybody an email address, I guess we still don't have. Because I sent everybody an email, because I put all the lectures online for you. All right, so let's see. I guess I'm going to log in. Okay. I think I did. I'll talk to you after class. All right, so how about let's check this one out right here. Okay, so here is Here is the email that I sent everybody. I don't have the lectures on Blackboard because they're way too big of a file to fit on Blackboard, but I put them on a server here at Cypress College. But if you click this link, you can go to my webpage at Cypress College, and you can see it right here. It's sem.cypresscollege.edu/jgober. So if you go there, you can see, well, here is the WAV file. What kind of program plays a WAV file? Like a media player, like Windows Media Player, Real Player, iTunes, various different players. So you can either listen to this recording, so this is of the actual lecture as it was recorded, and then this is a text file of a lecture that is similar. It's not exactly the same, but it's similar. So if people have a hearing deficit, they can still access that information. But, right? So, and then here is the cell lecture and the companion file to that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And here is the tissue file. So you can download or just play these. If you want to download this WAV file, maybe you want to copy it to an MP3 player. How would you download this file to your computer so that you don't have to access the internet again to get to it? Right-click it, right, with your mouse. So right-click, save target as. And then you get to save it on your computer. You get to pick a directory where you want to put it. Okay, and it won't take very long to download it, but I won't show you how to do that. If you want to see, let me know later. Okay, so for you, you would click Tools, and then I think Personal Information. Make sure you have a correct email address in there, and then you'll get all these nifty emails, because I might say something about a test or take a look at this website or that website, and it would help you out. Okay, any questions on that? Good. All right, well, let's get to today's lecture. So we're done with histology, and that is the integumentary system. Are we on there? Good. The integumentary system is composed of the skin. We have to define what that is. There's some layers that are important for making up the skin. And then some accessory structures. That might be best, just like that. And then some accessory structures. These accessory structures are going to be things like hair, nails, some muscle, a little tiny, tiny muscle. When you get cold or if you get really scared, that muscle contracts. And what happens? Goose pimples. You get goosebumps or goose pimples. It pulls a little hair follicle on end so it stands up and it makes a little bump on your skin. There's a little muscle that does that. And there are glands in the skin as well. There are glands that secrete oil so that our skin doesn't dry out, and then there are other glands that secrete a watery solution that helps regulate our body temperature. So that all is part of the integument. Sweat, for instance, exactly right. So there are sweat glands. So there are some functions of the skin that you should be aware of too. The skin protects internal structures from infectious agents and dehydration. So we would probably turn into a potato chip within about 5 minutes if we didn't have skin. We would dry out very, very rapidly. And if we didn't have skin, we would be susceptible to all kinds of infections. And what's a really bad infection right now? It's almost impossible to treat because it's resistant to antibiotics. Yeah, MRSA. And so that's a really, really difficult bacteria, but your skin keeps it out of your body as long as you don't perforate your skin, right? So that's real important. So, for instance, if somebody has a burn, what are your two main concerns about that particular patient? Infection, number one, and dehydration. Both of those, all right, can affect the patient almost immediately and kill them. All right, so the skin, as we said before, because there are sweat glands, it also helps regulate body temperature. And the skin is important for producing an active form of vitamin D. Unless you take vitamin pills, you need some sun exposure to make vitamin D. And vitamin D is necessary. Does anybody know why vitamin D is necessary in your body? We're learning some reasons. One is that it helps absorb calcium from our diet. So without vitamin D, we can't absorb calcium, and one of the effects would be on the bones. Our bones won't develop properly. And then sensation is also an important function of the integument. So what can you feel on your skin? Temperature. Like if I put an ice cube on your back, you would know. What else? Pressure. That's right. Vibration. Pain as well. Somebody pokes you with something sharp. Those are probably the important ones.
Why do we need sensation?
Why do you need sensation? Because it's a way that you are communicating with your environment. So if your environment changes, you want to be aware of that so that you can make some adjustment. So for instance, if you sit down on a hot car seat and it's so hot, it's been sitting out in the sun that it starts to burn your legs, right? Well, then you're going to get up off of that seat. So pain sensation and temperature sensation are real important so that you're communicating with the environment. Or if something jabs you that's really sharp and starts to damage your body, you can appreciate that and withdraw that part of your body from that stimulus. Okay? So sensation is real important. All right, so the skin has got two main layers, and then there's a third layer that we talk about in this part of the course. It's not really part of the integument, but it kind of fits with the integument, so we mention it now. And the two main layers of the skin are the epidermis and the dermis. And the epidermis is the superficial layer. What does that mean in everyday language? That's right on the surface. That's the layer that you can see. And the deep layer is the dermis. And guess what epi means? It means on top of. So epidermis means a layer on top of the dermis. So that makes perfect sense if you know what epi means. All right. And this third layer, which is not really part of the skin, but we talk about it right now, is what we call the hypodermis. And that's what we call subcutaneous tissue. And guess what hypo means? Below the dermis. So it's below the dermis. So now you know some layers right here. The epidermis is what we said, superficial. It's an epithelium. And it's a stratified squamous epithelium. And even this layer can be broken down into sublayers, which you have to be aware of. And some of the properties of the sublayers are important to know as well. Okay, the dermis is mostly connective tissue, and it's two layers thick. So again, there's some sublayers that you have to know what these sublayers are all about. But the hypodermis, we're not going to look at too much, so I'll just say something about it right now. All right, is not part of the skin. All right, it's connective tissue. It's a proper, it's loose areolar connective tissue. Sometimes we call this superficial fascia, superficial fascia. And so it's a delicate layer of connective tissue that helps attach the skin, namely the dermis right here, to underlying structures like muscle and bone. So it allows muscles and bone to move around, right, without dragging a whole lot of skin with it because that would cause inflammation. And another interesting thing about the hypodermis is that it could store up to half of a person's fat in that layer right there. So what kind of cells are you going to find in the hypodermis? A lot of adipocytes, right? Okay. And we can have adipocytes and loose areolar connective tissue. That's one of the cells that are in that diagram that's in your book. Okay. Loose areolar connective tissue? Areolar connective tissue has collagen fibers, some elastic fibers, right? It has fibroblasts and it has immune cells. It has some blood cells in it. Okay. Well, let's take a quick look at what the skin looks like right here. So here is a nice picture of the skin. And I'm sure this is an exam figure. And you can see the superficial layer. Here's the apical surface of this epithelium. And here's the basement membrane right here. So all of this right here, maybe here's a better look at it, all of this right here is the epidermis. And you can see, is it a simple epithelium? Absolutely not. It's stratified, right? There are many layers. And the way we name the cell shape is by the layer that's on the apical surface, not the basement region down here, not the basal region. And these cells are, they're squamous. So this is a nice stratified squamous epithelium. And we'll characterize it a little bit differently too because there's a special chemical that's produced in this epithelium that gives skin strength. It's inside cells and we call that keratin. So this is what we call a keratinized epithelium. The epithelium in our oral cavity is very similar, but those cells don't produce keratin. So that layer is not as tough as what's on our skin, and that's probably pretty obvious to you because I think in lab you looked at some buccal cells from your mouth. With a little toothpick, you scrape them off and look at them underneath the microscope. All right, so here is the epidermis. And then the dermis is a lot thicker. So here is the dermis, way down over here. All right, so we're going to look at some layers of the epidermis. The two main layers of the dermis are this papillary layer and then a reticular layer. Now, the interesting thing that I mentioned before in terms of epidermis is that it's a kind of tissue which is really strange because it does not have any blood vessels. And do you see any blood vessels in the epidermis? No. You find blood vessels in the dermis over here, right? Both in the papillary layer and in the reticular layer has blood vessels. And then we see some sense organs, which we're going to look at, and some glands here. Here's a gland that's attached to this hair follicle. Okay. So now let's look at the epidermis in a little bit more detail. So it's a stratified squamous epithelium, and it covers your body, so it's designed to resist abrasion. I don't know how many epidermal cells you lose every day, but if somebody wants to Google that and tell me, that would be pretty interesting. What would be my guess? I don't know, 10 million maybe, something like that. Millions of cells we lose every day. They're sloughing off all the time. So if I scratch very lightly my hand, right, and flick my finger like that, I just flick probably a couple thousand cells in that direction. But it's made to do that, okay? All right, but it's also a permeability barrier so we don't dehydrate. And it grows. Since we're losing these cells constantly, it has to grow. So let's look at some layers and how the cell grows. The deepest layer is what we call the stratum basale, and that's down by the basement membrane. These cells are undergoing mitosis, right? So they're going to replace cells that move up to the surface, and as they move up to the surface, they become incorporated into the most superficial layer, which is the stratum corneum. So here are two of the four or five different layers of skin that you have to start to become familiar with. The deepest one is basale, and the most superficial is corneum. The cells in the stratum basale are living cells. They are dividing by mitosis, reproducing themselves, and as they move from the stratum basale into the stratum corneum, they begin to produce a chemical inside themselves which is called keratin. And keratin is a tough chemical that gives these cells a hardness. But as they move into the stratum corneum, they also die. So the cells that are on the superficial layer or the stratum corneum are really dead cells filled with keratin. So all the cells that we're looking at right now are dead cells. Okay. And so they start off as columnar cells in the basale, and they become squamous when they get to the corneum, stratum corneum. Okay, the columnar cells are in the stratum basale. These are the cells that are undergoing mitosis.
The columnar
are in the stratum? Yeah, the stratum basale is made up of columnar cells.
Okay.
And then in the stratum corneum, these cells are squamous because, right, the columnar cells or the stratum basale is what? Near the basement membrane, that's the deepest layer. And the cells that are near the apical surface are the stratum corneum. And we always name an epithelium by the shape of the cells in that apical region. So this we call a stratified squamous epithelium. Because the cells in the apical region are what? Are squamous. They're squamous cells. So the cells change shape as they move from the basement region up to the surface. They change from columnar cells to squamous cells. Yeah. It's made, it's actually starting to be made in the basale as well, but there's one layer which I'll show you is most responsible for doing that. The cells of the stratum corneum are dead right now, so they can't really make anything. So the keratin really is made in these cells before they get to the stratum corneum. Okay, because they're dead. Now why do they die as they move up to the stratum corneum? Oh, okay, there's damage, there's the environmental conditions. But I think probably the most important reason is they're getting farther and farther away from blood vessels and nutrients, so they can't respond to stress like sun damage or chemicals in the environment or whatever, right? So they're moving farther and farther away from blood vessels. Okay. Some areas in your body, that stratum corneum produces a callus due to friction. You have a buildup of cells. You have many layers in the stratum corneum, and these cells probably even produce even more keratin within them so that it gets harder and harder and harder. I know that if you're a violin player or guitar player, what are your fingertips like? Yeah, they're callous. They're real hard. You can go tap, 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 tap if you play often, right? They're almost like fingernails. All right, and you can develop even another structure called a corn over a bony prominence. It's conical in shape and it's painful, and it's an area, it's just a deeper callus of cells that have filled with keratin, and it's real hard, so when you press on it, it presses down into the dermis and it's an irritation. Okay. All right, so let's look at some layers of skin. Maybe I got a good picture. Right here. So what are we talking about right now? From here to here, basically. And, yeah, the epidermis. And let's see if I can zoom into this picture maybe a little bit. Yeah. So here is the stratum basale right here. These are the columnar cells that are undergoing mitosis. And then some of them break away from the basement membrane and start to migrate up to the surface. And in this region right here, we have the stratum corneum. The cells in the basale are living. The cells up here in the stratum corneum are dead because they're really far away from these blood vessels right here. Okay. All right, so here is a really nice picture of some parts of the skin. So here is the basement membrane for our epidermis. And so here's the dermis way down over here. We just have a little piece of the dermis. And these are the various layers that we see. All right, so here is the stratum basale. And can you tell me about this cell right here? Okay, yeah, it's columnar, but I can see some chromosomes in there. It's undergoing mitosis, right? It's reproducing itself. This is an active place of growth in this particular tissue. All right, so that's one important function of the stratum basale. All right, the next layer, the next superficial layer from the stratum basale, and the stratum basale is only one, maybe two cell layers thick. I see it as one cell layer thick right here. Is the stratum spinosum, because in these layers right here, the cells start to form interconnections with neighboring cells, and it has little processes sticking out. So under certain kinds of viewing, these things are going to look like they have little spines sticking out of them so that the cells become glued together. So that's a process that happens in the stratum spinosum. And keratin is beginning to be made in this layer as well. So there are pre-keratin forms that are being made. So we call that pre-keratin. They're just filaments of keratin, and keratin is a protein that gives these cells strength from the inside. And these cells then keep migrating up to the surface. The next superficial layer is real thin. This is what we see, what we call the stratum granulosums. And in this layer right here, the cells are really beginning to die because they're really far away from these blood vessels. And these granules, these cells right here, they're also becoming waterproof. They're beginning to form a water barrier so that you don't lose fluids through the epidermis. And then the last layer right here, this is the stratum corneum. Many, many layers, and these cells are all dead. They're filled with keratin, which is a very strong compound, and then a glycolipid. And a lipid is an oil, and that prevents dehydration from occurring. All right, so those are some layers. Yeah. Right down over here. Well, because we're talking about the epidermis, right? And what's an epidermis? It's an epithelium. And how would you look at an epithelium? An epithelium begins at the basement membrane, and it continues all the way up to the apical surface. So when we look at that epithelium, when I look at that, I don't see just one layer. I see many layers. Okay, so it's a stratified squamous epithelium, and these layers can be categorized by how they look and how they are functioning. They can be broken down, and that's what we've done in the skin. Okay, so the stratum basale is just one layer of that stratified squamous epithelium. And don't forget, we don't name an epithelium by the cells in the basal region, because we'd have to call this, what, a stratified columnar epithelium, but it's not. We name an epithelium by its apical region. So these are squamous cells. It's a stratified squamous epithelium. Yeah. Say that again. A horny layer. Cornified because horns are hard. Okay, I think that's where that term comes from, because horns on cows and buffaloes and things like that are hard. So when they say cornified, it's just hard. So another way that they could have called it is like fingernail, because our fingernails are pretty hard. Okay, and we don't look at comparative anatomy in here very much, but a horn on an animal is kind of like hair that's wound together very, very tightly. So a horn is really a specialized kind of hair that's coming out of the animal, but, you know, thousands of hairs coming together. Okay, so cornified just means it's hard. Because, now why, a good thing that you should know is, why is this layer hard? Or relatively hard compared to the stratum basale? Okay, yeah, because it's going to protect our bodies from trauma. But I want to know about the mechanics. Why is it harder? I mean, not the reason, but why is the stratum corneum harder than the stratum basale? Because of a chemical that's inside of them, namely keratin, because keratin is produced on its way up to the stratum corneum. Those cells get filled with it and they become hard as a result. Okay. So in this class, you should know something about the cells, like names of cells. You got to know something also about fibers, like give me a name of a fiber that's important. Collagen, right? And where do you find collagen? In connective tissue. What part of connective tissue? In the matrix, which is where? Outside the cells. All right? Now that's what? Inherently a lot different than keratin, because where do you find keratin? It's inside the cell. It's not in the matrix. Because remember, an epithelium doesn't have a matrix. It's just cells tightly packed together. Okay. We got some other cells that we're going to be interested in. Here's a Merkel cell. This is for perception, for very light touch. It will send signals to the brain when the skin deforms just a little bit, stretches, so it gives you fine discrimination. Probably one of the reasons why people with vision deficits can read little bumps on a piece of paper, right? Braille, because you have very fine discrimination due to these receptors right here. And another thing I see is this melanocyte. And a melanocyte produces a pigment. And that name of that pigment is called melanin. All right, so here you can see some projections of that melanocyte moving up between the cells of the stratum spinosum even. And these cells will incorporate some granules from the melanocyte, and they will carry melanin with them up to the surface. And melanin, we said, is a pigment. Now, what the heck is a pigment? That's just a general name for a chemical that has color. So there are some pigments that look yellow, there's some that look green, right? There's some that look brown, blue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in human skin, they're brown to black in nature. Melanin is brown to black, and sometimes melanin might incorporate a little bit of iron, which will give it kind of a little reddish color in certain parts of your body. Like if somebody has a lot of freckles, that's going to be due to iron that's being incorporated. So the job of a pigment is to absorb light. And light is energy. Any kind of light is energy. But some forms of light have a lot more energy than others. And the more energy it has, the more damaging it can be to your skin. And as a matter of fact, that light energy is damaging to chromosomes that we see down over here. So any kind of cell that's alive that has chromosomes can be damaged by light, especially ultraviolet light. And melanin is a chemical that has evolved to absorb ultraviolet light, and that protects people from the harmful effects of solar radiation or sunlight. Right? So, as a matter of fact, probably the most damaging thing you can do to your skin is to subject it to sunlight. Even though we're living on this planet, sunlight is still very dangerous to us, even though we have a nice atmosphere with ozone and stuff like that. So, that's always interesting, because everything can be bad for you if you have too much, right? But a lot of times you need a little bit of these things to be healthy, right? So it's that balance. That's exactly right. So if you have a lot of pigments in your skin, you can afford to go out in the sun and get a lot of sunlight. But if you don't have very many pigments in your skin, you know, if you're fair-skinned and blonde, and you go out into the sun right now, for 10 minutes, what could happen?
Sunburn.
You could get sunburned, right? So for every person is different. Yeah. Depends on your exposure. I've never heard of any third-degree burns, so it doesn't penetrate down into the dermis, but it can cause some severe burns to where you get fluid buildup between the dermis and the epidermis right here, and that causes a blister. Okay, so you can get a second-degree. Yeah, that's going all the way down to here, and that's very damaging to the epidermis. Very, very damaging. Yeah, I don't ever want second-degree burns because it's going to slough off. It's going to damage the epidermis. Ah, okay. And if you damage that epidermis, what are you susceptible to?
Infection
and dehydration. Yeah, so sunburns can be life-threatening. Yeah. So if you get a really bad sunburn, you're going to need some penicillin or something. Yeah.
I kind of noticed when you mentioned about blisters.
Yeah.
There are times where it's like, when you get one, there are certain times, like when you try to get it out, there's sometimes, like liquid sometimes spins like 6 feet up.
Yeah. A blister A blister will form along this basement membrane right here between the epidermis and the dermis, okay? And so it's just fluid, and if you break that blister, right, then you then subject the dermis right here to infection, and there's nothing protecting you from dehydration from that area as well, okay? So if you have a blister, like a friction blister or something, just leave it be for a number of days to let it heal from within, and then you... Yeah, and then you can pop the blister. But I wouldn't pop it right away because you could get an infection very easily, and it's painful. You're not going to dehydrate from a little blister, but it's going to be painful. Okay, so here is that melanocyte that's responsible in all of us for producing a natural sunscreen. And what is that natural sunscreen called? Melanin. Right, so in this class, you got to go know names of cells, and if they produce a chemical, you got to know the name of that chemical, and then you got to know where it is, if it's in the matrix or if it's inside the cell, and what the function of that chemical is. Okay, so here is a really interesting kind of cell because it produces natural sunscreen. All right, and so what did I say was probably the most damaging thing you can do to your skin?
Burn it.
Burn it or go out in the sunlight. All right, so the darker your skin is, right, probably because we all have to go out in the sun, you know, and walk around, the darker your skin is, that probably just means that the longer this your skin will just stay young and vibrant and healthier because you just have more melanin that's being produced, okay? And the lighter your skin is, probably the faster it ages if you go out into the sun because the sun is very damaging because of those ultraviolet rays from the sun. And you know what? If we live someplace that was closer to the equator, like Australia, no one ever goes outside in Australia without a hat on, okay, because of skin cancer, right? And there are a couple forms of skin cancer. These basal cells can become cancerous. That's relatively easy to treat. But these melanocytes can even become cancerous. That would produce a melanoma, for instance. And that's currently very difficult to treat. And that's all due to sun exposure.
In regards to like certain skin cancers, if like left alone, like not treated, then it could develop into...
Oh, it could kill you. Especially, yeah, a basal cell here or melanoma. Melanoma is just very aggressive, very difficult to treat. That would be like the worst kind to have. Okay. Okay, so this is where they come from. Okay, down in this layer. The last kind of cell that I see right here is what we call a Langerhans cell, and this is, it's almost like a white blood cell, But we find it in the epidermis, and it helps fight infections. And so you can see it kind of crawling around between these cells of the stratum spinosum, and that will just help fight infection, bacteria, viruses, fungi that are trying to take advantage of your body. All right, so this is what thin skin looks like. And thin skin is the kind of skin we have all over our bodies. But in a few places, we have thicker skin. Guess where you have thicker skin? On the bottoms of your feet and the palms of your hands, right? You should know that that skin is a little bit thicker. And it has one additional layer. So let's see. Here is a nice slide that compares and contrasts thin skin, which is what we just got done looking at, with thick skin. All right, but let's not pay attention to the dermis. We just want to pay attention to the epidermis. So here is, does your eye pick out this basement membrane right here? And basement membrane right here as well. All right, so that's one of the first things when you look at epithelium, find that apical surface and the basement membrane and start to analyze it. Okay, so in thick skin, we have a very thin layer between the stratum granulosum and the stratum corneum right here. We call that the stratum lucidum, right in this region. All right, the other noteworthy thing is that look at the depth of the stratum corneum. So stratum corneum is from here all the way down to here in thick skin. But in thin skin, it's what? It's about maybe a little bit more than a tenth as thick. All right, so it's a lot thinner. So thick skin has an additional layer, and the stratum corneum is a lot thicker, and that just protects your body from abrasion. But it has all of the other layers. Like, for instance, the stratum basale. What's the next one? Stratum spinosum. And then the next layer is the granulosum, and then the lucidum, and then the last layer is the stratum corneum. Right? So those you should know what order they go in and be able to label these diagrams. Okay, so I think that's good for, well, let's look over what I've written down over here. So we're still talking about the, what, epidermis, right? We're still talking epidermis. So here's a little synopsis of the epidermis. The stratum basale, sometimes some books, especially older books, call that the germinativum, or germinating layer, or the seed layer that's growing, right? This is the layer that's undergoing mitosis. It has made up of keratinocytes. These are stem cells undergoing mitosis. A stem cell is what? A progenitor cell that's going to make other kinds of cells. It also has melanocytes that produce melanin, and it has these Merkel cells as a touch receptor, very light touch. After mitosis, then some cells will move up into the spinosum, that's the spiny layer. It's only a few cell layers thick, and this is where keratinocytes mature. There's very little mitosis taking place in this region. And this is where a form of keratin is made. We call that pre-keratin. And also in this layer, we have macrophages or immune cells that are fighting infection. The stratum granulosum, it's a thin layer. These cells start to produce keratohyalin. That's a glue, so the cells get glued together, as well as other granules that are granules filled with glycolipid. And lipid is what? A waterproofing compound, because water and lipid don't mix, right? That will prevent water from leaving your body. And the plasma membranes start to thicken and the cell begins to die because they move away from their blood supply, for instance. And even the nucleus and organelles disintegrate. So if you were to look at some of your stratum corneum cells underneath a microscope, it wouldn't be very interesting at all. It would just kind of look like slivers of something because they're not really living cells anymore. Okay. All right, and then the stratum corneum, the horny layer. We had a question about the horny layer, but it's supposed to be hard. That's what that means, hard. Yeah. Good question. I don't really know. Depends on probably the nature of the injury, but I would say in terms of, they might not replace much dermis, but they probably replace the whole epidermis starting at the stratum basale because that's the growing layer. And if you don't replace that, then it's not going to grow back. But I'll say some more about that. There might be some circumstances where they try to get some of the dermis, but maybe not. Depends on the injury. But that would be a really tough injury if somebody's really burned down deep into the dermis. Okay. All right, so what is extracellular glycolipid good for?
Waterproofing.
Prevents dehydration. All right, is keratin intracellular or extracellular? It's intracellular because it's not a connective tissue, right? It's just the epithelium. Okay, and then don't forget the strata. In thick skin only, we have the addition of the stratum lucidum. Lucidum means clear. And so it's situated in that transition zone between the granulosum and the corneum. And it's just a very thin band that contains dead keratinocytes. Okay. All right, the next layer is the dermis. And it has two main layers. It has a papillary layer, which is superficial, and it has a reticular layer, which is dense. So let's go back to this slide right here. I actually kind of like this slide to look at the dermis. So the dermis is where? Between the basement membrane of the epidermis, all the way down to wherever the hypodermis begins. And to tell you the truth, I don't see hypodermis on this particular slide right here. But so this region right here, right, is what we call the papillary region, and this region down here is the reticular layer. But it's a little bit of a misnomer because the reticular layer doesn't have a lot of reticular fibers in it. It has collagen. The dermis is connective tissue, so it's collagen in the matrix. And I see a bunch of collagen fibers all over the place, and you should be able to recognize that as not regular dense connective tissue because it's not completely filled up with keratin. This is keratin going in all kinds of random directions, right? That's dense, irregular connective tissue. So that comes from the dermis, in particular the reticular layer. So don't be misled by that term reticular layer. And as a matter of fact, when you have leather, where does that come from? That comes from, yeah, like a cow, but what part of the cow?
Skin.
Like the horny layer? It's the skin, right? But what part of the skin is it? Is it going to be epithelium?
No.
It's going to be dermis, and in particular, what? This dense, irregular connective tissue. So leather is real tough because it's made out of keratin. So this is all keratin that's left over from somebody's skin, probably cow, as you said, right? So that comes from this reticular layer. So reticular layer has collagen, not reticular fibers in it. I'm not an expert enough to say if there is much of a difference in the reticular layer between thick and thin skin. It makes sense that thick skin would have more, or maybe more collagen, but I just don't know. So I'm not going to ask you on the test. What's the difference in the reticular layer between thick and thin skin? Okay? Okay. But you should know that the reticular layer of the dermis has collagen in it, and that it's connective tissue, right? Dense, irregular. All right, the papillary layer is loose connective tissue. And see these projections right here, these bumps? These are what we call papillae. So these are like little pimples that are trying to poke up into the epidermis, and that's where this layer, where the papillary layer of the dermis gets its name from. All right, so the papillary layer is superficial, contains that subpapillary plexus. Oh, I haven't showed you that, but I will in just a second. It's areolar connective tissue, and the reticular layer is deep, right, and its strength is due to collagen and some elastic fibers, not reticular fibers. All right, let's go take a look at that first slide, which is this one right here. All right, so where is the dermis again? From that basement membrane all the way down to the hypodermis, and I can see hypodermis here because I see some nice adipocytes, right? So this is what we call superficial fascia. And so this is all the dermis. I don't really see much of a distinction between the papillary layer and reticular layer on this particular slide. Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably. It could be superficial fascia or hypodermis. And the hypodermis is not really part of the integument. It's just something that glues the integument to underlying structures. Okay? Okay. All right, so here we see dermal papillae, and that dermal plexus, let's look. Here's a nice dermal papillae. What do we have poking up into this dermal papillae right here? Yeah, look, we have a nice arterial supply, right? And then it turns into a vein, so we see a change in color right here. So there's a capillary bed right here. And the capillary is a place in our vascular system for exchange, where nutrients can leave a blood vessel, oxygen can leave a blood vessel. And so this is just one adaptation that allows nutrients and oxygen, right, to poke up into the epidermis, because the epidermis doesn't have any blood supply. So this supplies oxygen and nutrients to this whole area of the skin.
A lot of red blood cells there.
This one right here? That would be a Meissner's corpuscle. Yeah. Okay, notice that is also kind of placed up in that dermal papillae as well, but it doesn't have to be up in there. Okay. All right, so that's for a little bit different kind of touch. Okay, a little bit coarser kind of touch. Yeah. Where diffusion takes place, yeah. Where diffusion of oxygen moves out of a blood vessel and supplies oxygen to these cells, especially that basal region that are alive and undergoing mitosis. They need a lot of nutrients and they need a lot of oxygen to do that. Yeah.
In regards to the vascular system, yeah. Changes in the subpapillary. I'm looking at the diagram, it's like they almost seem to like interconnect to each other, like they somehow connect.
Okay, so here's the plexus and the papillae. And what's the other one?
The cutaneous vascular.
Oh, down over here? Oh, they are connected. They are connected. So the arterial blood comes in, right, through this junction between the hypodermis and the dermis, and then it moves through the dermis because the dermis has a blood supply up to this papillary region right here, the dermal papillae. And then the vein brings blood back to the heart. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Yeah, so these are just bigger blood vessels and these are smaller, because they're not carrying as much blood. Yeah. So for instance, you probably are aware of this because maybe you've gotten a paper cut and there are nerves in the epidermis, like that Merkel's disc, that you can damage and that gives you some pain sensation. There are free nerve endings as well in the epidermis. And you go, oh wow, I cut myself real bad because it hurt real bad. And then you look and you see you're not bleeding because you didn't cut yourself down into the dermis anywhere where there's a blood vessel.
Okay. I have to note though, like when sometimes I'm looking at the skin, those are like kind of like veins that like an aqua bluish.
Okay, that's probably a vein. That's probably a vein, not an artery. And veins are real thin so that you can see the color of blood that's going through them. But you don't ever see any veins. Well, hardly ever. I guess I do. Even with thick skin, you can see underlying blood. Okay? But that only happens when you don't have a pigment blocking your view of that, right? If you have a lot of pigment in your skin, you're not going to see any blood vessels in there. And if you're completely devoid of pigments, then you're going to see a lot of color from blood. So what is your color going to look like if you're completely devoid of pigments? It's going to look kind of whitish, but it's going to have a cast of like light red or pink. Okay, and there are people that can't make any pigments whatsoever. We'll talk about that condition in just a little bit. Okay. The vein? Well, there are veins in the dermis. There are veins in the dermis. You would have to point one out to me for me to know exactly which one it is. Okay. I'm not really sure. Okay. So that's the importance of that dermal papillae and the vascular nerve plexus. All right, so skin. Let's just talk about skin color for just a little bit. So pigments, what is a pigment?
Color.
That's something that we put in paint to get paint color. Some we put in fingernail polish to give fingernail polish color. We put it in a chair, you know, to give chairs color. And we also have it in different parts of our body to absorb light. So a pigment just absorbs light, and not all light, maybe certain kinds of light. That's why different pigments have different kinds of colors. And you're aware that sunlight is made up of what? Just one color, like white? It's what? Every color, right? Because you've all seen a rainbow, And so when sunlight comes in and it gets spread out, when it goes through a prism or a rainbow, it has all colors. We call that the visible light spectrum. And I don't know, what kind of colors make the visible light spectrum? So here's a little saying that you can use. I'm not going to test you on this, but this just shows you that sunlight, the visible light spectrum, oh, I can't point. I don't have my laser pointer out. It's red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. All right, and in that order. Maybe you can remember what a rainbow looks like and kind of visualize what that is. But of course, I have no idea what this is, but this is a really handy way to memorize what colors are next to each other in a rainbow. And melanin is such that it absorbs what? Most of these colors. So it absorbs everything. So it's kind of devoid of color. All right, so what kind of pigments does a plant have? Okay, this is sort of interesting. All right, the pigments in plant absorb blue, indigo, and violet, red, orange, and yellow. They use these energies to make sugars, and they can't absorb green. And so when sunlight shines on a plant, the plant reflects the green light, and that's what you see with your eyes, the leftover light that's not absorbed. Okay, and the darker a pigment is means what? It's absorbing more and more light. Huh? A plant is green because it doesn't absorb the green light. It bounces off, and when it bounces off, you see it with your eyes. The plant absorbs red, orange, and yellow, so the plant absorbs that, doesn't bounce off, and it goes away. You can't see it with your eyes. So they call that chlorophyll, is that pigment in plants. It looks green, it absorbs everything but green.
So in regards to like leaves, for example, like leaves on a tree.
Yeah, yeah.
You notice in the fall, the after spring passes, when fall comes in, eventually it starts to go from green and then from like red, orange, and yellow.
Yeah. What's the plant doing? The plant is reabsorbing materials that are in the leaves because it takes a lot of energy to build all those chemicals up. So the plant resorbs a lot of those chemicals so it doesn't have to build it again in the springtime. And that's the green parts, and what's left over are the other parts of the leaf that turn colors. Okay? So it's absorbing a lot of chlorophyll when that happens. Not all plants do that, but some do. All right, so skin color, primarily due to pigments. And it's also due to blood, especially in parts of your body where typically we don't have very many pigments. Like where our lips don't have very many pigments. So what do lips look like? Somebody should tell me. I don't know. Pink? Do they look pink? Okay. Because you see blood in there, right? You have highly vascular lips. All right. Don't forget about that natural sunscreen. We call that melanin. That's a brown to black pigment. It takes different forms in different people. And melanocytes produce melanin in the stratum basale. And let's see, moles and age spots increase the number of melanocytes in somebody's skin in one area as they grow older. They just start to proliferate and populate some small area. Freckles are an increased melanin production in some localized areas. So the melanocytes don't proliferate, but they just get more active in this particular region. And they might actually incorporate a little bit of an iron. And iron is the pigment in blood that gives blood its reddish color. Yeah?
I have a question. How come moles stick out and freckles don't?
I don't know why moles stick out. Well, there are maybe probably different kinds of moles, for instance. And a freckle is probably more just epidermis. And a mole probably also, if it's a skin tag, it actually incorporates a lot of dermis as well. And a mole can have a hair follicle growing out of it, but a freckle won't unless there's something underneath it. All right, so a mole is really a more complete skin, which is epidermis and dermis all together, and it has blood. A mole will have blood in it, but a freckle won't have blood in it. Okay. Okay. Kiss it goodbye. That's what I would do. Yeah. Yeah, why? Unless you want to go see a doctor every 6 months or whatever. Okay. Yeah, if I had something, we'll learn about one primary reproductive structure. in people. It's either a testes or an ovary. Okay, and in the male, where are these reproductive structures? They're outside your body, right? They're in the scrotum. They don't belong inside your body, because if they're inside a male's body, they will turn cancerous. All right, so what should you do in that case? If it's not cancerous now, but you know there's potential for it to becoming cancerous, yeah, remove it. Yeah, to me that's simple, but it's not my body, okay? Okay. All right, let's talk about a couple conditions right here that change skin color a little bit. Albinism is the inability to produce melanin. It's congenital. That means what? You're born with that. It's not developmental. It's not something that develops over your lifetime. You're born with an inability to produce melanin. So it's inherited. You get this from your parents due to genes that you inherit. And so a person will look just like some combination of their parents, just like their brothers and sisters, but completely devoid of any kind of color. All right, so you're going to have absolutely white hair, absolutely white skin, but it might look a little pink because you have blood, of course, close to your skin. And what can you tell me about people that are suffering, I don't know if I would say suffering, but are that have albinism living in Southern California? Oh, that's going to be really difficult because the sun is very strong. Right? So we don't see very many people with albinism in Southern California. But where would be a place, if you had albinism, that you would like to live in? Yeah, like Alaska maybe, or Seattle. And indeed, there's a much higher population of people with albinism in cities that are way high north because they won't get skin cancer quite so easily. I would say absolutely. I don't know if I've ever stared into the eyes of somebody. But yeah, I just never seen it. And if I did, my vision for red is so poor, I wouldn't even know. Okay, yeah.
So it's albinism because it's more of like a rare disease?
It's pretty rare. But you know what? All animals, any kind of animal, can be an albino. Like there's albino giraffes and tigers and snails and squirrels. There was this one famous town in Illinois that had this huge population of albino squirrels and had a bunch of white squirrels running around all over the place. And of course, they're really obvious in the environment if they're bright white, so they have a tendency to be heavily predated upon, so that kind of gene doesn't live for very long in a population. Okay. A white mouse is probably an albino mouse. And if you look at their nose, it looks what? Pink. And if you look at their eyes, red or pinkish, right? And their ears are pink. And all those white mice and white rats, they're almost clones of each other. They're almost identical. And so they're bred that way for scientific purposes. Okay. Okay, cyanosis. What the heck is cyanosis? That's a bluish cast to somebody. And that could be due to, it is due to the kind of blood that's circulating in their body. Normally, when blood is oxygenated, when your heart is functioning properly and when your lungs are functioning properly, your arterial blood supply looks what kind of color?
Red.
Yeah, see this blood vessel right here looks red? It's going to produce a red or pink color to you. But if the heart and lungs aren't working properly and this blood is not being oxygenated, the pigment in blood, which is hemoglobin, isn't bound with oxygen and it's going to have more of a blue color to it. And so that person is going to have that bluish cast, and we call that cyanosis. And you don't really know if it's due to a lung problem or a cardiovascular problem or both. And that's one of the things that somebody looks at immediately as soon as you're born, right, to see if somebody is cyanotic, because that's an indication of what?
Not
enough oxygen, and that could be due to a blood problem or a heart problem or a lung problem or maybe a combination of all of these things. All right, jaundice. It's kind of interesting because it produces a yellow cast. And actually, not just a cast, it can be a very bright yellow color. I actually knew one person that was being treated for liver cancer with some pretty hardcore chemotherapy agents. And their skin just looked bright yellow. The whites of their eyes were bright yellow. Maybe not quite as bright as that, but maybe like your chairs or something. Okay, just really, really bright. Yeah. I don't have a sign-in sheet for today. Sorry about that. Okay, so where does this jaundice come from? Could be due to liver disease, right? Because the red blood cells in your body break down all the time. As a matter of fact, you lose about I usually ask this question, but I'll tell you. Usually about 2.5 to 3 million red blood cells die in your body every second. That's amazing. And you have to, of course, rebuild those red blood cells, that many every second. So when those red blood cells die, it releases all that hemoglobin, and it has to be dealt with, and it's the liver that usually deals with all that hemoglobin. So if somebody's blood is being broken down very quickly, or if their liver can't handle that load of hemoglobin for processing, maybe due to liver disease, then a byproduct of hemoglobin called bilirubin and biliverdin will build up in a person's body, and that will produce jaundice. And again, that could be found in an infant, for instance, if there's some mismatch in the mother's blood with the infant's blood, and it was missed in prenatal care. Okay, that can produce jaundice. So skin color in a newborn is very important, diagnostic procedure. Okay, so that's what jaundice is. Birthmarks in the dermis is just some localized increase in vascularity. What do we mean? You just have some area in your dermis that has a big ball of blood vessel someplace. So it looks darker compared to other parts of the dermis in that region. Okay, so that would be a birthmark. Hair. Let's talk about hair for just a little bit. This is a thread-like structure consisting of columns of dead epithelial cells filled with keratin. So hair compared to the stratum corneum, do you think has more keratin or less keratin? Probably has more, because hair is harder. It's a tougher kind of structure, right? And the way that the cells move out of the skin is more of a column as opposed to flat sheets. And so hair has a different structure, different nature to it. The shaft of a hair lies above the surface of the skin. The root and the bulb are below the surface of the skin. And a hair follicle, okay, it's made up of the root and the bulb, is a deep invagination of the epidermis, and we say that this is a nice reservoir for epidermal cells. And someone had a question about this already. So let's go to this picture right here and just talk about, well, what does that mean, a reservoir of epidermal cells? Let's see if I can move this just right. So here you can see the hair shaft, right? So here's the stratum basal. And what layer is the stratum basal? That's the living layer, right? And notice when it gets to a hair follicle, what happens to it? It goes all the way deep down to the base of this hair follicle. So it's down deep inside the dermis. And so that's real important for people that get burns. So let's just talk about burns for a little bit. A burn that just burns a little bit of the epidermis right here is a first-degree burn. Not too dangerous. You might dehydrate a little bit more susceptible to infection, but still, the person is really, really lucky, right? What happens if they get, and a second-degree burn kills more epidermal cells to where now you get fluid building up on right at the top of the dermis right here? It's a little bit more dangerous, more susceptible to infection, more susceptible to dehydration, but the stratum basal probably is still alive. Right, it's been damaged, but it's still alive. So what does that mean? That means that it can repopulate the epidermis because it's still alive. Now, what about a person that gets a burn all the way down, kills all of the cells down into the dermis at this region right here? Is that a lucky person or an unlucky person? Okay, I hear a lot of unlucky, but I want to change your opinion about that. I would still maintain that they're very lucky because look at that stratum basal. It goes all the way down over here, it hasn't been damaged, right? Because of that hair follicle is making that stratum basale continue deep down, almost into the hypodermis on this particular slide, right? So this person still can regenerate their epidermis from this area of skin cells around the hair follicle. So this person is still pretty lucky. It might be really hard to convince them of that, but nonetheless, because look at all these free nerve endings right here, those are pain sensors.
Burn.
Okay.
It's
so it's going to burn the nerves, it's going to burn this little muscle that I haven't talked about, but at least, right, the skin can grow back, right, the epidermis can grow back because of all these cells, right, in the stratum basale surrounding a hair follicle. Now what about a person that gets burned all the way down past the bottom of this hair follicle right here? Okay. Now that's a really unlucky condition. because their skin will never grow back no matter what we do, even if we protect them from dehydration and infection. So now what do they need? They need a graft. They need a skin graft from some other part of their body, and probably they actually need to get a immediate skin graft from a donor animal to protect their skin from dehydration and infection, right? So that's really unlucky. So that's the beauty of knowing layers and where they go in the body. It really determines outcome, right, and how we want to help these people. So you got to know all the different layers and all the tissues that we're going to be looking at. Yeah, in the back. Right here? So you say you see some capillaries in the dermis. Yeah, like right here?
Yeah, and then there's
like here? These are nerves. So the yellow is a nerve right above there. You want to know what this thing is right here? Yeah, that's a gland. And I haven't talked about glands yet, but that's a gland that secretes sebum into the hair shaft right here, and that's a waterproofing material. It's an oily material that helps lubricate the skin, and it also helps as a bacteriostatic agent. It also helps fight infections. So this is not a sweat gland, but a sebaceous gland. And we do see a sweat gland right here. And it has a tube that goes all the way up to the surface of the skin and probably empties out over here someplace. Okay. Yeah. With a what? Oh, a tattoo. You know, I don't know where they place a tattoo, but I would say it can't be in the epidermis because you lose the epidermis all the time. It will just wash off eventually. So it's got to be into the dermal layer right here. And some more evidence for that is when you get a tattoo, you probably bleed a little bit. Right, so that needle is going into the dermis and depositing, right, those pigments. It's got to be a pigment of some kind into the dermis, and that's more or less permanent as a result of that. Okay. I'm not really up on what kind of pigments to use that are ones that are more permanent or others. I would say the location of where they're placed is probably more important than the nature of the pigments. All right, so we're going to finish up integument next time. So you might want to look at some glands and the muscle. Yeah. Our test is on a week from today. I think it's a week from today. I think it's on a Wednesday, yeah. It's kind of a screwy week because we missed Monday. It's been a long time since we've been in class. Yeah.